Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Simpler, Chris Dodd said today, is better. Simpler rules, simpler regulations for Wall Street. It took him 1,100 pages to do it, but at least today we got a plan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com.
From the studios of WABE in Atlanta, Georgia, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 10th of November today, and it is great to have you with us. You know how when you have to refill the printer at the office and you grab one of those packages of paper from the carton underneath? That's 500 pages, a ream of paper. Put two of those reams together, you still don't have enough pages to print out the latest plan to regulate the financial industry. Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd released his reform bill today, 1,136 pages in all. The draft I saw this morning took five pages just to list the cast of characters, all the various regulators and government officials. And therein lies at least part of the problem. There is no person, no single person, no agency in charge of keeping an eye on the financial system. Senator Dodd lays out his fixes in those 1,100 pages. We gave Marketplace's Steve Hann a minute and 45 seconds to make it make sense.
One of the big problems during the subprime boom was that mortgage underwriters didn't hold on to billions in risky mortgages they helped create. So when those mortgages failed, they didn't lose a dime. Senator Dodd would change that.
We will require companies that sell products, such as mortgage-backed securities, to keep so-called skin in the game so that they won't sell worthless securities to unsuspecting investors.
Dodd would also create one unified federal bank regulator. Right now, bank supervisors come in at least 54 flavors. Every state has its own agency. And Washington offers up an alphabet soup of its own, the OTS, the OCC, the FDIC, and the Fed. Dodd's bill would trim the choices. And Rick Carnell, a former banking regulator who's now a professor at Fordham, believes Dodd's bill does a better job than the administration's proposal at preventing the next crisis.
He makes it harder to bank on a bailout.
Carnell says that while one agency would police the banks, another would just write the rules. He argues this simplified structure will make it easier to head off crises before they get out of control.
And that includes making it easier to make decisions that will be unpopular with the industry.
Like the House, Dodd also wants to create a new consumer financial products agency. Consumer advocates like Susanna Montezemolo at the Center for Responsible Lending argue this consumer watchdog would ultimately protect banks.
Many of the practices that have been most harmful to consumers in the long run have been very bad for the businesses themselves.
Still, Dodd's bill is likely to draw fire from community banks, credit card companies, and others. It doesn't have a single Republican backer and is likely to be amended many times before it finally comes to a vote next year. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
One more item falling under the purview of the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee before we move on. Senator Dodd said today he thinks Ben Bernanke will be confirmed for a second term running the Federal Reserve sometime before Christmas. Bernanke's current appointment expires at the end of January. As long as we're talking about banks and the Federal Reserve, the next group in line for a government bailout could be a branch of the government itself. The Federal Housing Administration is said to be running out of money. The FHA has been an important part of the housing market. It kept on making loans long after financing from the private sector dried up. So we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler what a broke FHA might mean for a just recovering real estate industry.
The Federal Housing Administration isn't inspiring tons of confidence these days. A Washington Post story says the FHA has less money in its reserve fund than is required by law. Also, the government lender recently delayed the release of an independent audit of its finances. Budget analysts speculate FHA may need to tap Treasury funding to the tune of $20 billion. Still, some believe FHA is a good bet for a bailout. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
in principle, this could be made up in the future. The FHA had basically been run at a profit through most of its existence and presumably will be again once we're through this housing crisis.
When times are good, profits generated by FHA flow back to the Treasury. And FHA plays an important role in the housing market right now. Since banks have cut back on their mortgage lending, Baker says FHA has picked up the slack, now handling almost a quarter of the new mortgages being issued. In response to FHA's financial problems, Congress may force it to adopt stricter standards. Douglas Elliott with Brookings Institution says anything that reduces new FHA loans would be a mistake.
They are acting in a public purpose. We really want the housing market to stabilize, and if we were instead to have the FHA pull back, it would be one more thing knocking housing prices down.
FHA officials declined to comment for this story, but they will break their silence on Thursday when the FHA will release the results of the delayed independent financial audit. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
With the billions and trillions of dollars that are being thrown around in the macroeconomy, a relatively modest acquisition of just $750 million managed to slip under the radar yesterday. Google said it's buying a company called AdMob. It specializes in placing display ads on mobile devices. We've been hearing for a while now that smartphones and the like are the new frontier for marketers. And with Google in the game, the stakes just got higher, as Joel Rose reports.
There's an old joke in the marketing industry.
That next year is the year of mobile. And people have been saying that for every year for the past 10 years, and it's never quite been the year of mobile.
Noah Elkin is an analyst at eMarketer. With so many consumers now accessing the internet through smartphones, Elkin says next year may have finally arrived.
We're in a situation where marketers and advertisers are playing catch-up with consumers.
Which is why Google was willing to spend $750 million on AdMob and its mobile advertising know-how. Andrew Frank is an analyst at Gartner Research.
What's particularly new and different now is the revolution in smartphones, particularly driven by the iPhone. I think that really has changed a lot of the way that consumers are using phones, and I think that that's going to drive a lot of growth in mobile advertising as a result.
What's a lot? Predictions range from $1.2 billion to $13 billion a year by 2013. Right now, mobile advertising is worth about $400 million a year, and that's just a fraction of what gets spent on online advertising. Neil Strother is an analyst at Forrester Research. He says one thing marketers like about all those iPhones and BlackBerries is that they're so personal.
A mobile device is not a shared television or a shared experience, maybe on a family PC or something like that. The platform is on a person just about 24/7, except when they're asleep, but it's usually by their bed or nearby.
Strother says Google just bought itself first place in mobile advertising, but as usual, he thinks competitors like Microsoft and Yahoo will be doing their best to catch up. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a calmer ride than it has been lately. A little up, a little down. We'll have the details when we do the number. President leaves for an eight-day swing through Asia on Thursday. He'll stop in Tokyo, Seoul, and Singapore along the way. He will also spend 3 days in China. There is obviously a limit to how much you can get done in 72 hours of state dinners and bilateral meetings. But to get some idea of what might be at the top of the president's list, I spoke earlier today to China scholar Kenneth Lieberthal.
I think he wants to accomplish two things. One is to introduce himself, his vision of the United States, and his vision of U.S.-China relations to the people of China broadly. He's a new commodity. He wants to get the people of China to become a little comfortable with him. Secondly, he has a substantive agenda, which is really very significant. The key thing about the substantive agenda is it focuses primarily on global issues. And it's only this year that global issues have really come to the center of U.S.-China bilateral relations. The three big issues are the economic and financial crisis, clean energy and climate change, and the issue of nuclear proliferation.
Do you think there's going to be agreement on that climate change issue? I mean, last I checked, it was very much the Chinese saying, we're not going to curb our emissions until you do something, and the Americans saying, oh, come on, you got to help us out.
Well, I think it's important to differentiate clean energy from climate change here. The big bilateral issue right now is clean energy. And the advantage of focusing on clean energy is threefold. One, clean energy is more than 80% of how each of us needs to address climate change, so substantively important. Secondly, the politics of clean energy are much simpler than the politics of climate change, because you don't have to get into total emissions and historic responsibilities and all that kind of thing. You can just look at projects that are win-win projects and get going on them. If we can get together on the issue of clean energy, announce some serious cooperative projects, is going to help a lot as we go into the broader global climate change negotiations. Other countries regard us as the biggest problems on climate change. So if we can demonstrate we're willing to work together and work together focused on clean energy, I think that's going to have some positive spin-off effects.
Can we demonstrate that, do you think?
I think the current plan, we'll have to see what actually happens, but the current plan is to issue a joint statement at the end of the president's visit to Beijing. And I expect that statement to have some specifics on various initiatives that we'll do together in the clean energy space. So I think, yeah, there are some real deliverables that we will see within a few days.
Number three on that list of global issues was the global economy. What can we expect there out of this meeting?
Each of us are so interdependent with the other that, for example, we count on China continuing to buy our sovereign debt. They count on us to pursue policies that don't produce a rapid decline in the value of the dollar because they've invested so much of their wealth in dollars. So I think what we'll see here is an ongoing, deep discussion of the key issues that concern both of us. Among those will certainly be the issue of protectionism. Both leaderships have a lot of internal pressure to take protectionist measures. I think both recognize that that's not a good way to go. That will be one of the issues that will be scrubbed pretty thoroughly.
What about the Chinese currency, the yuan? Much of the conversation is centered on the relative value of that and the dollar.
The Chinese effectively pegged their currency to the U.S. dollar, and we would like to see them increase the value of their currency vis-a-vis the dollar. They're very nervous about doing that, and they're nervous in part because they have a lot of job pressure at home, and increasing the value of the currency will likely make it more difficult for them to export and therefore puts more downward pressure on export-oriented jobs. So I think that's going to be a tough one. Over time, I would expect the Chinese to revalue the renminbi, their currency, upward. But I think in the coming few months, I will be pleasantly surprised if that occurs.
Kenneth Lieberthal, he's a senior fellow in foreign policy and the global economy at the Brookings Institution. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up more than 200 points yesterday. It was up a hair today. But the past week or so has been more hair-raising than anything else, swings of a couple of hundred points in either direction. The general trend, though, has been positive. The blue chips are up 50% from their lows back in March, all of which is making our own Rico Galliano surprisingly anxious. So we asked him to figure out why.
Last winter was a dark time for my investments, but years of working on Marketplace at least meant I knew what to do as the market plunged. Nothing. You don't sell at the bottom, right? Problem is, now the market's coming back, and things aren't so clear. Is this the top of the market? Is now the time to sell?
Fear and anxiety are a natural response to a lack of predictability.
That's Jennifer Lerner, director of the Harvard Lab for Decision Sciences.
When the market shifts and things become less predictable, less knowable, fear and anxiety are likely to occur.
And not knowing how high the market could rise can be as scary as not knowing how low it will go. Now, that fear can be good. It makes me less likely to take my market gains and bet them all on a hand of blackjack. But it can be bad if it keeps me from taking well-calculated risks.
What most of us do is we focus on this is how much I could gain or this is how much I could lose, and we're overly influenced by that. But what we need to do is instead multiply that loss or gain by the probability that it occurs.
In other words, yeah, I could lose my retirement fund if the market implodes, but how likely is that to happen? There are actually formulas called expected utility calculations you can use to figure this out, or you could take the standard investment advice to avoid risk. Diversify. Richard Thayer is at the University of Chicago.
Stick to a sensible asset allocation, be internationally diversified, and then read the sports section.
Unless you're a Cleveland Browns fan, in which case that's not going to mellow you out at all. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Cap and trade is easy when you run on nuclear power.
All the other ways we have of trying to deal with the climate problem are much more expensive for the consumer.
That's coming up in a conversation from the Corner Office Climate Change Edition. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average ticked up just 0.2% today, 20 points, closed at 10,246. The NASDAQ slipped 0.1%, nearly 3 points, ended at 2,151. The S&P 500 basically flat, closed at 1,092. News of falling home prices in about 80% of U.S. cities took the wrecking ball to home builders in a big way. D.R. Horton, Pulte Homes, and Hovnanian Enterprises all fell roughly 3.5% today. Beazer Homes bucked the trend, rising 8.75% after it posted its first quarterly profit in 3 years. Floor Corporation fell 7.5% today after it reported disappointing earnings. Bond insurer MBIA plunged more than 26% today. That after it reported a third quarter loss yesterday. Alcoa jumped nearly 1% on news it's going to invest $110 million in the Cleveland Works Press. It makes parts for fighter jets. Priceline soared more than 17% a day after the company reported better than expected earnings. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-notes rose to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com. American Public Media presents Workplace You, an American Radio Works documentary supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. Events at Arlington National Cemetery mark Veterans Day. Technologists are gathered for AppSec DC 2009. That's a web security conference happening in Washington. And the dapper actor who portrayed Howard Hughes, one of numerous roles, celebrates his birthday. Leonardo DiCaprio will be 35. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Nearly 2 years' worth of a desperately slow economy have affected a huge slice of the U.S. population. No matter your income bracket, your career path, or even where you live, you almost certainly know or know of somebody who's lost their job, or you yourself have been laid off. But the recession has affected another, more specific group, too, the mentally disabled. They want to work as much as anybody does. But jobs for them are even tougher to come by, as David Martin Davies reports now from Texas Public Radio. Here's a new argument in the debate over how much we need to be doing to control global warming. The International Energy Agency said today, if we don't do something to control the pollution that traps heat in the atmosphere, chances are we'll just keep on using more and more of the oil and coal that produces that pollution, and that will eventually drive up both the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and energy prices to boot. The Senate is working on a climate change bill, one key feature of which is a system known as cap and trade. The government sets a cap on how much of that heat-trapping pollution an industry can produce. The companies then trade whatever part of their quota they are not going to use. Companies that find ways to reduce emissions can sell their pollution permits. Companies that keep on polluting have to buy more of those permits. And so economics drives a drop in greenhouse gases.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a utility company chief executive who favors cap and trade. John Rowe runs Chicago-based Exelon. It is this country's biggest generator of nuclear power, a technology that does not produce many greenhouse gases, by the way, but does have plenty of problems of its own. And when we spoke earlier this week, I asked him why he wants the government to give away those carbon pollution permits for free, at least at first.
If you're a large coal-burning utility or a customer of a large coal-burning utility, you have a huge stake in seeing your utility get some of these initial allowances for free, because otherwise you'd have huge short-term price shocks in the early years for the customers of coal-burning utilities. It happens it's not as big an issue for my company because we're mostly nuclear.
So if those permits are given away for free, then Exelon would do pretty well, right? Because your carbon footprint is fairly low. You'd get the permits, and then you'd trade them.
First, we wouldn't get as many permits because of that. And second, all the permits we get would be given to our distribution companies where the state regulators would use them for the benefit of the consumers.
Do you think cap and trade has to be part of this energy bill that's making its way through Congress, or is there another way that this thing can get passed and work out for the good?
The only other way that works out for the good is a tax, and it's very unpopular. Cap and trade is essential because all the other ways we have of trying to deal with the climate problem are much more expensive for the consumer. We've tried to price in terms of the cost of avoided carbon dioxide, different forms of energy supply. You can mandate we do this with wind, that's $50 to $80 a ton. You can mandate solar, that's $300 to $700 a ton. Whereas the cap in the box or cap and trade bill is initially as low as $28 a ton. All the other ways of dealing with the climate change problem cost the customer a lot more, a lot sooner, and create a great deal more economic disruption.
Exelon is one of several high-profile companies that has left the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in part at least over the chamber's stance on climate change. Could you give me some insight into your thinking as to that decision and what
prompted you to it? Well, I can tell you all of our thinking because it was a decision that we took 5 minutes on.
Wow.
To us, this was not such a major thing. We've been a member of the chamber for a long time. We've never been active enough to be part of its policymaking body. We believe the chamber plays a constructive role in many issues, but the chamber was taking a position that was against our views and our interests on the climate bill. It was stating that position very strongly and harshly, and we didn't think we should be paying dues to an organization that was opposed to us on the issue that's at the absolute top of our priority list. But this wasn't some sort of general discontent with the chamber. They just weren't representing us, so we withdrew.
Just as simple as that?
Just as simple as that. And it was a five-minute decision.
Any dissent around the boardroom as you took the vote?
I didn't take it to the board, and the dissent is several people have suggested that I should have.
and you still got your job, so it worked out all right.
It didn't occur to me that membership in a trade association was a board-level issue.
John Rowe, Chairman and CEO of Exelon. Mr. Rowe, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
To hear John Rowe's thoughts on the odds of getting a cap-and-trade bill through Congress and what might or might not happen at the big UN climate change meeting in Copenhagen next month, the rest of our interview is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which a little Supreme Court history runs right up against the recession. Pfizer, the drug maker, announced yesterday it's going to shut down 6 of its 20 research and development facilities. Not all that surprising in light of the economy. One of those 6 facilities, though, happens to be in New London, Connecticut, and that is where the Supreme Court comes in. 4 years ago, the justices ruled in a case called Kelo versus New London. They said the government does indeed have the authority to exercise eminent domain over private property, that is, take it at fair market value, and then give it to a for-profit company to promote overall economic development. The for-profit company in the Kelo case was Pfizer. Pfizer is now leaving New London, and the lot on which Suzanne Kelo's house used to sit before it was taken is now a vacant lot. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow ticked up just 0.2%, 20 points, closed at 10,246. The NASDAQ slipped to 10%, nearly 3 points, ended at 2,151. The S&P 500 traded flat, closed at 1,092. Thanks to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew, also Doug Krisner there. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Thanks today to the staff here at WABE. And coming up tomorrow back home in Los Angeles, stingrays are threatening the oyster and crab harvest in the Chesapeake Bay. So one solution.
We try and develop it as a food source to take them out of the bay and have it on the menus.
Oh, my delicious. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.